also to have a congregation which is more fluent in Hebrew than in English. Looking out at your wonderful faces, I really defy any rabbi in America to stand up and say that Torah is dead. For a group of this size to come out in an evening such as this, to hear recreate the life of a Jewry long gone is indeed a tribute to the interest, the alertness of the congregation, and I hope it says something good about the rabbi. This evening I'm on the side simply to give you as clear a view as I can of the screen. I hope in a brief time to begin showing you a series of very interesting and sometimes very beautiful pictures and slides which will illustrate my theme. But first, you must enter with me into my time machine. We'll set the controls to go back some 1,700 years to a time when Rome ruled the world, or at least that part of the world that we Westerners learn about in our history. We plan to set down on the easternmost border of the Roman Empire in a frontier fortress and market town on the upper reaches of the Euphrates River. Perhaps some 50,000 soldiers, purveyors, craftsmen, and their families lived and worked within the walls of Dura. These men and women were here because, in fact, Rome did not rule the world. Downriver and across the flat plains of Mesopotamia lay the mighty empire of the Sassanids, dotted with cities which had been highly civilized, quite powerful for almost 2,500 years. Ardashir, the Sassanid king, who was on the throne, was the first of his line. Just a few years before, in 226 CE, he had led a powerful nativist uprising against a Parthian nobility which had ruled Persia for some 500 years. When Ardashir defeated his Parthian enemies, he began conquering nearby Roman territory. The fortress of Dura was to fall to him in 256, together with most of eastern Syria. Although we will fly home before this defeat, I'll get you home safe and sound, it is important to us because had Dura not been captured, destroyed, and evacuated, it would not have become the rich archaeological treasure house that it is today. Rome is, of course, still pagan. Constantine will not see the Christian light for almost a century. In addition to a synagogue and a small Christian church, the walls of Dura enclose a dozen or more temples to such gods as Adonis, Zeus Kyrios, Artemis, and Zeus Megistos. On their part, the Sassanids were zealous followers of the prophet Zoroaster, dualists who worshiped the god of light and truth, Ahura Mazda, and who served in his legion against the god of darkness and evil, Ahriman. Fire was the symbol of the great god, and the fire altar was a central shrine of his faith, presided over by priests called the Magi. Zoroastrianism was already an ancient faith, and had been predominant in the Babylonian-Persian area for almost 800 years. So much so that some of its doctrines had already exerted considerable influence on Judaism. For they provided an environment which stimulated eschatological ideas, the piety of physical resurrection, strict rules of ritually clean and unclean objects and foods, legends heavy with angels and demons, and a rather vivid and picturesque and concrete description of the future reward and the future punishment. At our time, the second quarter of the third century, Jewish life is slowly regaining some stability after the devastating convulsions of the first two centuries of this era. Jewish Palestine had been shaken and irreparably weakened by the bloody Roman suppression of revolts which had broken out successively in 66 AD and in 132. The second century had also seen large-scale fighting between Jews and Romans in Syria, Cilicia, Cyrene, and Egypt. Yet Palestine remained the spiritual focus of Jewish life. The temple lay in ruins, but each day in the diaspora, men prayed for its restoration and for the enthronement of a descendant of the house of David as ruler of an independent Israel. The Persian Jewish community outnumbered the Palestinian to the order of 5-1, but it had to turn to Palestine for religious leadership. The lands between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers had never developed centers for rabbinic training and study. They practiced a rather loose biblical Judaism, long after Judaism in Palestine had undergone the Pharisaic transformation. Precisely in the years in which we will land, a significant number of Babylonian Jews went to the academies in northern Palestine and the Galilee, at Usha and Tiberias, trained there in the law, and returned to their cities where they founded the academies of Hutztal, Hardea, Pumpedita, and Sura, schools which were to produce in short order the Babylonian Talmud and to be synonymous with Jewish learning for the next 700 years. By the third century, that Pharisaic Judaism, which we now call rabbinic, had pretty well proven its case. The Jewish communities throughout the diaspora began to accept the Palestinian Pharisaic interpretation of scripture, which wove a tightly knit web of custom and law around every aspect of a Jew's life. The basic code of this law, the Mishnah, had been edited some 30 years before, around the year 200 CE, and was generally accepted. The ritual of the synagogue replaced the rites of the temple in Jerusalem. Rather simple Torah rules of Sabbath observance, forbidden foods, and the like were extended, refined, defined, and interwoven with modern, what we would call modern religious significance. The authority of the religious scholar became acknowledged. Theological doctrines of an afterlife and of reward and punishment in the afterlife became normative. To put it simply, a scholarly, profound, an all-embracing religious civilization was in the process of being woven into the lives of 1,000 separate and scattered communities, where heretofore Judaism had been a matter of a few rather simple rites, reverence for the sanctuary, reverence for God, reading of the Torah, ethical teaching, and a shared destiny. Now, even as Jews stood on the frontier of the Roman world, so it was on a frontier within Jewish life. It had economic ties both to the south, to what Jews called Babel, Babylonia, Persia, and to the west, Syria, and to Eretz Yisrael. Jewish merchants brought the textiles, the furs, the grain, and the glassware of Syria to Persian markets, where they were exchanged for silk from China, spices from India, and indigenous dates and honey. The Jewish communities of Persia were old. They trace their history to the Babylonian exile of the 7th pre-Christian century. These communities were compact, for the Jews had settled largely along a network of canals in central Persia, which interlaced the land between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers near the royal winter capital of Ctesiphon. The Persian Jewish community was not unlike our American Jewish community, where the vast majority of the Jews congregate in and around New York City. At the very time we come to Dura, two of the most important teachers in all of our history, men by the name of Rav and Samuel, both merchant scholars and physician scholars, were bringing the ideas and practices of Pharisaic Judaism to Babylonia, creating academies there to teach the rabbinic way, and beginning the process of gradual religious change, which was to kindle the light of rabbinic learning in the lands which comprise the eastern half of the Fertile Crescent. We've come to Dura because of a fortunate political misfortune. In 256, the Sassanids overran Dura and the town was abandoned. The records of this community were buried safely under its ruins so that they were not scattered or lost over the intervening centuries. A dozen years before Dura was captured and abandoned, the Jewish community there had built a new synagogue and a block of buildings directly behind the river wall. During the Persian siege, Roman engineers sandbagged these walls for added defensive strength, and their military precautions save the magnificent frescoes that you will soon see. Also saved was a baked clay tablet on which the synagogue building committee had inscribed their names in much the same way that plaques are placed here and there about the temple as memorials of loving concern. The chairman of the building committee and synagogue president was a man by the name of Samuel Bar Yediah. Samuel's name tells us a good bit about his world. Bar is an Aramaic word, the equivalent of the Hebrew ben, son of. Roman officialdom at this time spoke, of course, Latin. The Sassanid court spoke Pahlavi. In the marketplace, all citizens spoke Greek and Aramaic. Aramaic is a niece of Hebrew, and it was the lingua franca, the common language of the common people of the Near East. And strangely, you know some Aramaic. The Kaddish is written in it, and so are parts of the biblical books of Ezra and Daniel. The Talmud is heavy with it. Now, despite the great similarity of Aramaic and Hebrew, Samuel Bar Yediah probably understood only a smattering of the Holy Tongue. When the Torah was read in his synagogue, a translator known as a meturgeman stood directly beside the trained reader and rendered a line-by-line interpretation. In time, the best of these translations were written down. They provide us an indispensable key towards the understanding of the biblical text, for they tell us how the Bible was understood in these early centuries. The Targum, or Aramaic translation, and there are many of them, is in fact more than a translation. At times, the text is embellished. At times, the text is reinterpreted. And these embellishments and these reinterpretations tell us a good bit about Samuel's religious attitudes. The frank anthropomorphisms, the description of God in human form, of some of the Bible text disturbed him. For example, this verse from the story of the Garden of Eden. I quote, "And they," that is Adam and Eve, "heard the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden." The Targum reads, "And they sensed the memra," that is the spirit of the Lord, "going about in the garden." A direct sense perception, "and they heard the voice of the Lord walking in the garden," becomes simply an awareness of the divine presence, and they sensed the spirit of the Lord going about the garden. The word memra is interesting. It corresponds to a technical term in Greek philosophy, logos, and stands as mute testimony that the broad outlines of Greek thought were part and parcel of the intellectual worldview of Samuel and his colleagues. Well, I must add this, that this delicacy about anthropomorphic language in the Bible is strange indeed when you relate it to the pictures you will soon see, which include direct representation of the hand of God reaching down from heaven. But apparently, art had its rules, and biblical interpretation had its rules. The biblical canon, that is, our text of the Bible, or rather, the books which we include in our Bible, was fixed in its present form in the first century of the Common Era. However, popular tradition had embroidered the biblical text over the centuries with any number of additions, some legendary, some descriptive, some containing specific reference to post-biblical events, some messianic in their outlook. Some of these extrapolations still had biblical force in Samuel's world. For example, Hannah, as you know, is the mother of Samuel. And Samuel was the man who anointed David, Israel's first and most famous king, and the king Messiah, from whom the king Messiah was to descend. Now, one of these embellishments added to Hannah's prayer a rather clear and straightforward prophecy that the temple would be rebuilt and the messianic dream would come true. It goes in this fashion. "And Hannah prayed by the spirit of prophecy and said, 'Behold, Samuel, my son, is destined to be a prophet over Israel. In his days they will be delivered from the hand of the Philistines. And by Samuel's hand there will be performed for Israel wonders and signs. Wherefore my heart is strengthened in the good portion which the Lord has given me.'" And then she follows with a series of prophecies over Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, who destroyed the northern kingdom in 722, over Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, who destroyed the southern kingdom in the end of the 6th century, over the Greek kingdoms which had precipitated the Maccabean rebellion, over the sons of Haman, known to you from our Bible, from the book of Esther, and she concludes, "So Jerusalem, which was like a sterile woman, is destined to be filled with the people of its captivities, while Rome, which was filled with many peoples, Her army shall cease, and she shall be laid waste and destroyed. This dream of redemption expresses very clearly the common hope and the religious expectancy of Samuel and his fellow Jews. Now let's note for a moment Samuel's private life. Samuel was delivered by a midwife at home and circumcised with appropriate ceremony on the eighth day of his life. I hope the mole did better than I did just then. Circumcision, as you know, is the ancient symbol of God's covenant with Israel. During the circumcision, the baby was held by his godfather, who was still known by the Greek title Syntechnos. The title Syntechnos became elided over the centuries into the still familiar name Sandek. Beside the Syntechnos, there was an empty chair, a chair for Elijah. Elijah was the legendary herald of good tidings who would announce the arrival of the Messianic Age. Later, this chair of Elijah and its symbolism was moved from circumcision to your Seder table, where it still symbolizes Israel's hope of redemption. There are other more or less superstitious overtones to this place set for Elijah at the bris. The Bible, as you will recall, tells Elijah once restored the life of a widow's son, a widow who had befriended him. Basing itself on this tale, folk legend elected Elijah as a semi-divine protector of children. The rabbinic theology frowned on this kind of semi-divine being. Samuel's faith and that of his families included heavy overlays of Persian angelology, stories of angels and demons. Undoubtedly, he and his wives and his children wore protective charms and amulets. And I have here three of the kinds of charms that were worn. You will notice that there is a holder here. This is probably worn as a bracelet, as a necklace, or as a belt buckle. And it includes magical incantations to protect the wearer against disease, sickness, illness, misfortune, bankruptcy, and the like. These incantations can be read any way you want to. The whispering of magic formulae was part of a doctor's standard therapeutic equipment. The mezuzah on Samuel's doorpost was certainly looked on as a guard against evil spirits. At his wedding, he and his bride jumped three times over a bowl of live fish. Let's hope they made it. The fish, because of its many woe, was a universal symbol of fertility. In all probability, there was buried beneath the cornerstone of his house an incantation bowl with formulae for the safety, health, and fecundity of the home. And this is such a bowl. Simple, clay. It's written in Mandean, a Persian text. If you come up afterwards, you'll see three fish disporting themselves at the base of the bowl. The Mandean is simply a magical incantation. And this was buried beneath the lintel of the house, in order that the good things hoped for by these wishes and magical whisperings might come true for those who lived in the house. Samuel believed in astrology, and he was periodically encouraged and dismayed by the signs of the heavens. Astrology was practiced by the most cultured men of the age. Given their model of the universe, it seemed scientifically valid. They saw the earth surrounded by concentric rings of energy, which contained the stars and the planets. God was the prime mover who set the outer ring in motion. In turn, each lower sphere was set in motion in much the same way as a gyroscope top is moved from the outside today. And presumably, if you understood the motion of the outer spheres, you could predict not only the tides in the seas, but also the tides in the affairs of men. So universal was this belief that a 6th century synagogue in the Galilee, which I'll show you a bit later, actually had a brightly colored circle of the zodiac in a beautiful mosaic design placed into its floor. Now logically, astrology implies some form of predestination. And as you well know, Judaism has ever insisted on human responsibility and the doctrine of free will. But Samuel and most of his contemporaries held on happily to both teachings, and I suspect that in this audience there are still a few secret morning readers of the horoscopes. Samuel grew up in a world which celebrated the same holidays we observe, though less formally and without the overwhelming emphasis we have put on the high holidays. In all probability, the Sabbath made the greatest impact on Samuel's life. The Sabbath was announced by the blowing of a shofar. The first call in the early afternoon reminded those who worked in the fields beyond the walls that it was time to start home. An hour or so later, another shofar call signaled to the storekeeper that it was time to close his shop. A third call, shortly before sunset, told the women to light their Sabbath candles, which were not our tallish tapers, but squat bronze oil lamps such as this one. Three wicked, the oil was put into the center, sufficient oil to burn for the entire 24 hours of the Sabbath period. This is a refinement of those little pottery single wick lamps which you have seen in the much earlier archaeological results which have come out of Palestine itself. As dark set in, a final tekiah and truah announced that the Sabbath had begun. The Sabbath evening was spent at home. Sabbath morning, men and boys came to the synagogue. Women sat in the same room, but apart, and entered by a separate door, and apparently few came. In Samuel's youth, the synagogue was a smallish, whitewashed room some 20 by 20 feet in size, and distinguished from his apartment only by a low plastered bench which ran along the four sides, and by a Torah shrine in the west wall facing Jerusalem. The Torah scroll was neither covered nor cased. During the week, it was kept behind a decorative curtain, which is the progenitor of our parochet, the curtain we keep before the ark. The floor was colorful with oriental rugs. During the worship, men bowed and even at times prostrated themselves. Besides the ark, there was a special seat with a curved stone base, not unlike a crude throne, and it was here that the kassis, or elder, sat. The synagogue was a place of worship, and it was also a place of community meeting. And this chair was the chair of authority from which the presiding elder of the Jewish community managed such meetings. There were no prayer books. The basic liturgy was learnt by heart. Rote memory was still the basis of education. One who was better versed than the rest went down from his bench to a place before the Torah shrine from which he led most of the prayers. The prayers were sing-songed. We do not know about musical accompaniment. The forms of prayer were highly localized. The Shema, the Amidah, the reading of Torah were standard. Beyond this, each congregation evolved its own patterns. Because of this flexibility, the third century was liturgically one of the most creative in our history. The Aleinu, the great prayer towards the end of our service, let us adore the ever-living God and render praise unto him who spread out the heavens and established the earth, was written at precisely this time, as was a good bit of the confessional we still use on Yom Kippur. It is doubtful that a small community such as Jura held daily services, which rabbinic rule began to require, to replace the three times daily sacrifices which had been held in the temple. More likely, the men paused in their work at customary hours each day to recite the Shema and its blessings. The shofar may have been sounded from the synagogue roof at these times, much as church bells pealed in medieval Europe to remind the peasants that it was the time for the Angelus. When Samuel was young, the Sabbath was not his only weekly visit to the synagogue, for the synagogue was his schoolroom. Here, beginning at the age of five, he learned his alephbet, the alphabet, of course, to read and to write and to understand scripture. About the age of 10, he completed these studies, but until then he sat in this one room with boys of many ages and of many levels of schooling. Classes were held from dawn to dusk, 5.5 days a week, and no provision was made for lunch. They were hearty souls. The classes ended Friday noon and began again Sunday morning. At the age of 10, Elementary schooling was over. Parents apprenticed some of the boys to craftsmen. Samuel probably went with his father, who was a merchant. Teenagers then came with their father on Sabbath afternoon to classes conducted by traveling visiting scholars. Durer had no advanced school and no academy. Those who wished to study rabbinics had to travel west to Palestine. Now, this elementary education was not as parochial as it may seem. The Hebrew alphabet and the Aramaic alphabet were identical, as were the Aramaic and Hebrew numbering systems. Then, too, the synagogue was not only a school and a place of worship, but a town meeting hall and a hostel. The boys listened to their elders debating public policy and thereby learned law. At Durer, the synagogue had 6 or 7 extra rooms where visiting merchants could be put up. These men told the boys of their trips to China, India, Egypt, Rome, taught them geography and merchant law, and regaled them with tales of the great men and great events of their day. In the marketplace of Durer, Syrians, Romans, Persians, and Greeks thronged, and many a father who destined his son to be a merchant hired foreign language tutors for them. As an apprentice merchant, Samuel was not only tutored in languages, but sent to travel deep into Persia and to the great markets at Damascus and at the ports of the Mediterranean Sea. On the way, he probably visited the Galilean academies where he met the leading teachers of the age. After a few years of trade, it was time for Samuel to marry. He was probably between 18 and 20 years of age at this time, and his bride only in her early teens. The match was arranged by their parents, but the custom was that no father could marry his daughter against her will, and that no man need marry a woman who displeased him. The wedding was held in 2 parts and as much as a year apart. First, there was the betrothal, which was held in the bride's home, where the financial arrangements were completed. That is, the agreements were drawn up concerning the dowry and the wedding portion each family was given to secure the young couple's future. This is the origin of our ketubah. With the signing of the engagement documents, the marriage was deemed legal and could not be broken except by divorce. The actual wedding was held months later and in the groom's home. The wedding itself began with a gay processional through the city streets. The girl, attired in her finery, was led by her family to the groom's home, which was called the chuppah, where blessings were said, songs sung, and a feast that lasted 7 days, enjoyed by all, or overly enjoyed by all. The central ritual of the marriage was the giving to the bride of a ring or valuable by the groom, with a still-used phrase, Hale at Mukudeshet Li, behold, thou art sanctified unto me. Incidentally, the cost of the wedding was borne by the groom's family. And even then, rabbis were complaining about lavishness and conspicuous consumption. Marriage was not yet monogamous, though monogamy was held to be the ideal state. Rabbinic law had outlawed the Oriental practice of concubinage. All wives were legally on a par. Samuel probably had 4. High infant mortality and business needs required sons, and his wealth made more than one marriage possible. Now, there are some, I am sure, who would look back longingly on polygamous days. But let me assure you, that having read these documents, polygamy only compounded marital sorrows. A contemporary of Samuel's is quoted as saying, best to marry one wife, but if you marry 2, make sure you marry a 3rd. Apparently, a husband's diplomatic skills had greater scope if he had 3 women to play off against each other. One always liked him. When Samuel's father died, Samuel, as the older son, closed the dead man's eyes, anointed his body, dressed him in a simple shroud. There were no undertakers. The father's mattress was overturned and remained so during the entire 7 days of the Shiva. That same day, the day of death, Samuel rent his garments and led a lamenting and wailing procession, which carried the corpse in a basket litter to a family graveyard where the body was buried without a coffin. He Here prayers were recited, and Samuel and his family stood in a row while the mourners filed by and offered comfort. There seems also to have been some food and drink served, not unlike our current practice. The custom was as today, to visit in the mourner's home during the 7 days of the Shiva, and to bring in food and friendship. At a later time, perhaps after a year, it was Samuel's responsibility as the elder son to collect his father's bones and to place them in a more permanent burial place in an ossuary. Such was the routine of daily life in Dura. Now let me take you to Dura and let you visit the city and the synagogue. You turn off the lights, please. Is that in focus? There we go. This is Dura, a fortress city protected by natural ravines through most of its sides. This is the Euphrates River, which carried the water traffic down into the markets of Persia. Here is the remnants of the great wall which protected the riverside of the city. And it was right here, behind the wall, that the synagogue was built and was unearthed. Good. Now this is a reconstruction of the synagogue location of Dura. Here is the great wall. Here is the synagogue building. In front of it is an open columned courtyard where probably during the hot days open air meetings were held. Note that buildings were built in a block. There are probably 8 or 9 domiciles in this square block, which is fortress-like. People yet did not trust their neighbors. Notice also that the entrance to the synagogue was also the entrance to a number of other homes in this building block. There's a whole tractate in the Talmud which deals with a subject known as Eruv. Eruv was a system by which Jews could get around some of the more rigid restrictions of the Sabbath, which limit you to how far you can travel outside your home, but within the property which is yours, you're allowed to travel and to pick up objects and the like. By placing a doorway at the head of an alleyway, off which a number of homes opened, you in fact declared all of these homes one home and the synagogue part, and you could travel openly and freely within this entire area. This is one of the few times that we found a visible architectural design of this important element in traditional rabbinic law. The synagogue is the biggest building and the tallest building in the block. The open-air courtyard is not as tall as the building itself, so that a number of windows could be cut into the wall of the building. This is the east wall, to let in the morning light. Here is a plan of the synagogue itself. These are the rooms which were apparently used to put up merchants, caravan masters, and the like who came through the town. One entered the synagogue through this area, wandered into here, came up 4 steps into the open columned court. The men and women went in through this door. The men and boys went in through this door. The women entered through here. You can see around the edges of the top building, which is a synagogue building itself, a low bench outline, which I'll show you later, and at the very top in the west wall, a niche, which was the Torah shrine or ark. This building was reconstructed in Damascus for the Syrian National Museum. And I show you this simply to give you a sense of the size of the building. The inside building was about 28 feet high, 40 feet by some 30 feet in size. The masonry is all modern. The columns are rebuilt on the basis of architectural findings. Now here is one of the walls of this synagogue, still in place, though the top frieze has been taken away. This is the Torah shrine. The Torah was placed in a niche here. Note, to our surprise, that the entire synagogue on all 4 sides, from floor to ceiling, was covered with frescoes. When it was whitewashed, painters painted quickly onto the wet plaster, and the results you shall soon see. Here is the bench. The plaster has, of course, fallen away. Here is the special chair, the throne chair of the Cassis, from which the elder of the city managed, with Robert's rules of order, the meetings of the community. Here is another view of the Torah shrine, reconstructed, columned, beveled. You can see a lion, an antelope, and I'll show you soon the other pictures which abound. This in color is the shrine, it's the Torah shrine itself. You'll notice on the upper left the menorah, the most ancient and ubiquitous of all the symbols of Jewish art. An esrog and a lulav, a seven-columned building which is a standard symbol of the temple in Jerusalem. You'll find very similar motifs in Bar Kokhba and early Palestinian coins. On our right, and I'll come to this in more detail in a moment, you will see the story of the sacrifice by Abraham of Isaac. You'll see this more clearly in a closer view. There's a cornucopia shell here of some kind, a decorative shell. We don't know its significance. These are simply fluted columns, and the whole was the one architectural design which dominated the building. Here's a closer look at the pictures themselves. Abraham, Isaac bound on the altar, the ram, we say in our translation, caught in a thicket. The Aramaic translation had him caught in a tree, so the tree was the symbol they used here. What is the relationship of this story to the temple? Mount Moriah, where the sacrifice of Isaac was supposed to have been ordered, was believed by tradition to have been the place where the temple in Jerusalem was built and founded. Up on the top, there's a hand of God, an open hand reaching out from a cloud. I'll show you some of these hands much later and in much greater detail, symbolizing the miraculous quality of the scene. Now, we don't know whether this scene and other scenes were meant to be simply decorative, to be symbolic of the great sanctities of Jewish life, to convince the people that the synagogue did, in fact, take the place of the temple in Jerusalem, and that the repentance which could be offered for Israel in the temple could be offered in the synagogue, or if it was part of the audiovisual program of the school. Possibly it had all of these reasons. But all of these motifs are among the most familiar in our tradition, and they are all associated with the great temple. Notice the lack of perspective. It's on one plane. Size alone really shows you the importance of the object. Can you focus that, please? Now, this is one of the strips on the wall of the synagogue. It depicts the story of the birth of Moses. And there arose a new Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. And Pharaoh ordered the building of great store cities, Pitom and Ramses. All this is presumably the Nile River. And he ordered that the Jews be the slaves on these building projects. And this was not enough, for he ordered that all the Jewish male children be killed. And these are the two midwives whom he summoned, according to the Bible, to give the orders. One, the mother of Moses, attempts to save her child by putting him into an ark or a basket in the river. Unfortunately, the basket has been lost. He floats down the river, and he's found by the princess bathing in the river, gets the ark, picks up the infant Moses. The princess is attended by three of her courtiers, and she hands then in time the infant Moses over to Miriam and to his mother, who act as his wet nurse and as his nurse. We have, in a sense, a magnificent, shall we call it a strip, which shows the action of an entire story. We did not know the significance of the hangings. Apparently, it was simply to cover otherwise empty space. Interestingly and shockingly is the picture of a nude woman in the synagogue itself, which raises the question, what are these pictures doing in a synagogue in the first place? Isn't the second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images, nor any manner of likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or the earth beneath, or the waters beneath the earth? She's standing in the waters and certainly qualifies. The answer seems to lie in this. Judaism prohibited all that which was worshipped, whether it be icon, or idol, or statue. Rabbinic law prohibited anything in a synagogue which was fully rounded as sculpture or in deep relief, but as simply a picture in one dimension on a wall was not deemed to be idolatrous. We know of all kinds of animal and human form and angelic form in the Temple of Solomon, and certainly in Hellenistic times, as we're seeing tonight, the walls of their synagogues abounded in a rich tapestry of art. Here's a closer picture of Pharaoh on his throne, surrounded by two of the members of the royal palace. This hand outreached of the man on his right is a traditional form of acclamation. These are meant to be the bulrushes along the Nile. Here is the mother of Moses. Here are the two midwives. A close detail shows that this midwife has an instrument attached to her wrist, which apparently is one of the traditional instruments which assist at birth. Here is a closer view of the second part of the scene. They actually assume this to be an ark. Here are the bulrushes. Here's the infant Moses, the princess, her three helpers who are carrying lavers and pitchers and jewelry boxes and the like, and finally the two Jewish women who are to care for the infant Moses. This beautiful figure is a figure of Moses at the burning bush. Can you see up here on the right the hand of God to signify the miraculous quality of this bush, which burns but is not consumed, from which Moses receives the command to go back and to redeem the Jews? Notice this empty pair of boots. They're not there for a shoe shine. Moses was told, take off thy shoes, thy sandals, for this is holy ground. As you know, in most of the Near East, men take off their sandals, wash their feet before they enter into a sanctuary. Moses has on dress, which is traditional of Greek Hellenistic people at the time. This is the scene of the Exodus. Here are the hailstones, symbolic of the plagues, pouring down from the heaven. Here are the doors, symbolizing the open doors that have been broken open to achieve freedom. There are some protective deities, Nikes and the like, over the door. Here are the hosts of the Jews, soldiers, elders, another row of soldiers, a row of the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude, the ordinary people, a father touchingly clutching the hand of his child, a great figure of Moses here in the same dress as before, his staff held high over his hand, the magical staff with which he placed over the sea, leading the Jews out of Egypt. Why are the Jews pictured as warriors? Because the biblical word chamushim means armored, and one of the midrashim speaks of the Jews as bearing armor. Two of these people clasp in their hands vessels of gold. Remember, the Jews asked to have the jewelry of the Egyptians to go out with them that they might make the pilgrimage to God. It's a highly symbolic and highly effective scene. Here's the rest of the Exodus story. Moses, with his magic wand, with the Egyptians sinking into the Red Sea, their hands flayed out in desperate hope. The hand of God symbolizing the miracle of the sea opening up and then closing. Another scene, Moses on the other side of the river, the Jews freed, even the fish of the sea jumping in joy, and God's hand stretched out from the heavens again symbolic of the deliverance. This tradition, the hand reaching from heaven, grows and matures until it becomes Michelangelo's full figure of God, the Sistine Chapel at the creation of the world. This scene depicts the temple in Jerusalem. This is Aaron in the vestments of the holy priest, the high priest, his name in Greek above. This man is blowing a shofar, as is this man. These animals are presumably the animals brought for sacrifice. The inner building is presumed to have three doors covered by a curtain on the inside, however, when it's open. Here again is the seven-branched menorah. Here is the ark, the Holy of Holy Ark. Here is the altar on which sacrifice is offered. Here are two bowls from which incense is burning or some other kind of sacred fire. A closer view of the same scene. You can see now, I hope, the little image on the rooftop, on the gable. These are Nikes, protective deities, symbolic of the ease with which the Jews appropriated some of the mythology and some of the legends which were about them. This is a strange scene. If you count the tents, they're number 12. It seems to be a scene taken not from the Bible, but from the Midrash of our people. In the Bible, at several occasions, you know, the Jews complain about the lack of water or the bitterness of water. And Moses takes his staff and places it in the water, and the water becomes pure to drink. Now, what we seem to have here are a series of faucets, of pipes, hose, which is leading from the fountain to each of the tents. There is a midrash to the effect that there was a well, a magical well, which went with the Jews wherever they went in the desert. And it was from this well that each of the 12 tribes drank. What we apparently have is a highly symbolic representation of this. These are the figures symbolic of the tribes. This is a figure of Moses, differently garbed. Again, the menorah. Again, two great posts with a censer on the top. This strange object with legs is apparently a depiction of the table on which the showbread was placed before the altar of God. Now, this looks like almost any hunting or military scene from Persian art down through the centuries. Actually, it represents on the walls of the synagogue at Dura a battle between the Philistines and the Jews. The heroes always in white. And it's no more than a battle scene, a battle, by the way, in which the Jews proceeded to lose. We're not very good at this kind of thing sometimes. After the battle, the Philistines carry away the Ark of the Jews, the Ark of the Covenant. In this Ark are the holy vessels, the holy things, the covenant of the Jews. Note how from this kind of conception of the Ark, the Oriental Torah cases, some of which we have in our museum, come. The armor-clad men are simply Philistine soldiers. Captive Jews are carrying the Ark into one of the Philistine cities. Now, the Bible tells us that once this ark was brought into a temple of Dagon, one of the Philistine temples, twice, on two different occasions, the great idol of Dagon simply fell off its pedestal and was broken into pieces. To preserve that temple in fear, the Philistines ordered that the Jews take back their ark, which is then brought back, according to the biblical story, led by two oxen on a cart and brought back into Judea. These are apparently descriptions, picturizations rather, of various kinds of sacred vessels. This is another description or visualization of the temple in Jerusalem. You'll notice that there's seven walls, different colored walls. Seven is the ancient figure for protection. These walls, this depiction hoped for the protection of this temple. It is it is columned with masonry on the inside of the columns, a great door typical of so many basilicas throughout the Middle East that these people knew. Again, the three doors. This scene, which has very close similarities to some early things in later Byzantine art, is the anointing of King David by the prophet Samuel. This is Samuel. This is the cruse of oil. This is David. And these are his brothers and attendants. David, of course, is the hereditary founder of the Messianic line. This is not only a scene of past history, but of present hope. This scene represents part of the story I told you earlier of how Elijah brought to life the child of a widow. Here's the widow dressed in her dark clothes. Here's the dead child. Here's Elijah with a child in his hand, the hand of God, signifying the miracle about to take place. The revived child, the mother dressed not in mourning, but in joy. The whole scene capsuled in one beautiful frame. Here's an interesting story, at the beginning of one. The Bible tells us that Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal to a great test of strength, of the strength of their gods on Mount Carmel. They were each to offer sacrifices, and the one who sacrificed would accept it would be a great holocaust, and the other would remain wetted down and unlit. In order to, according to the Midrash, not according to the Bible, a certain Canaanite by the name of Hiel hid himself underneath the altar of the priests of Baal so he could light a match from inside. But God wasn't to be outdone, no siree. God created a great big serpent who came along and bit Hiel. And that was the end of Hiel's heel. And Elijah's victory in a poor joke. Here's a scene depicting the acceptance, the holocaust, the burning of Elijah's sacrifice. Here's Elijah. And here, interestingly, are four people who brought water to wet down the sacrifice before, lest any chicanery or tricks, the pouring of naphtha had taken place. Elijah apparently wasn't to be trusted by these Canaanite priests, but the Jews said, even so, this great legendary victory took place. Now this scene is rather more familiar to you, I think. Here is Haman leading Mordecai, vindicated through the streets of Shushan. Our Purim story. Haman is deliberately dressed as a member of the poor class, the peasant class. He doesn't have the great flowing garments or the rich royal garments in which Mordecai is dressed. This close-up view I show you for one reason, for a puzzle and a mystery which has not yet been solved. If you look closely, you notice that the eyes of Haman and of Mordecai have both been gouged out. And we don't know why this happened or when it happened. If some pious Jews broke into the temple at some point and gouged out the eyes of these figures, lest they be worshipped as idols, perhaps. But if so, why were not the other eyes gouged out? If some kind of native uprising brought this about, iconoclastic movements were familiar in this area. Or perhaps this was just the result of some boyish truancy. We simply don't know. It's one of the unsolved mysteries of Jura. This is the completion of that scene. You want to see the earliest depiction of Esther? Here you have her. Here is the king Ahasuerus surrounded by his court on his royal throne. Now this scene, and the last which I'm going to show you from these particular pictures, tells an interesting event in the life of the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel is told by God that he will be picked up and transported to a valley. Again, notice the miracle. And he will notice in this valley dismembered and disfigured, dismembered rather, bodies, dried bones. And then a great miracle will take place. The earth will come into tremor. There will be shaking and all kinds of strange and unexpected sounds, but it will all be miraculous. For the bones which have been dismembered will slowly be gathered together into their original and complete form. Now go ahead, please.
Did you want the other
chair? No, I want you to the next picture after that. again are these bodies miraculously brought together. Then the Bible tells us the four winds will come and they will breathe life into these bodies. And these winds, interestingly, are done in the forms of angels. Here, the largest of them. And they will breathe life into these bodies. And now one more, please. And the host will rise up alive. And this prophecy is symbolic of the resurrected Israel, dismembered in captivity in Ezekiel's day, brought back to life and to hope. Again, another great statement of the miracle. Now, if you'll switch to the other pictures, please. This completes the best of the representation I can show you from Dura. Now, imagine that all of these strips and 50 like it were on the four walls of this room. Above it was a ceiling done in wood with tiles between each of the wooden columns, highly decorative tiles. And to show you more of the art of this time in this world, this is a mosaic from Beit Alpha that we're now in Palestine. Samuel Ben Yedaya may have seen it. Again, the scene is of the sacrifice of Isaac. You see the knife. Abraham's name is now written in Hebrew, as is Isaac's. Here is the altar. It's all very colorful. Notice the line in black across the top of the mosaic. This is the curtain, the circle of heaven, from which the hand of God, a rather gross hand here, is coming down, a symbol, symbolic of the miracle which is about to take place. Here's one of the strange wild animals which abound in the mosaic and the floor of the synagogue. This is the menorah. The top's a little bit lost, I'm afraid, in the curtain, with the shofar and all kinds of exotic fruits about it. This is the sign of the zodiac from the floor of this synagogue. And remember that not only was this a floor, but the Jews in those days actually got on their knees and prostrated themselves on the ground, so that it might have been confused with the actual worship of these symbols. So prevalent was this view. You can see the twins, fish, Scorpio. Here's another synagogue, this one a Palestinian one, columned with a forecourt, three-gated, and the basilica building to the back. I spoke earlier of an ossuary, the final resting place for the bones. This is Palestinian. You see the large menorah coming up, announcing there's a Jewish crypt. And there are a lot of crypts here into which simply the bones were quickly and easily deposited. These are all underground, of course. Here is a headdress worn by the bride on her procession, belled, very gay. And here's how she might have looked. All bedecked, a thing of beauty and a joy forever, until the day after the wedding. Here are three very lovely glassware pitchers and containers. The larger one was apparently a perfume container, which come from a community much like Dura, Jewish and of the third century. And here's a little seal in Greek found with apparently a symbolic representation of the temple, found in Dura. It might have been on a part of a piece of glassware, somebody, or some other thing of this kind. Now we turn on the lights. That, I'm afraid, is all that I can show you. History has been kind to us, but not overly kind. But I do hope you've received this evening some impression of the life and the art and the faith of our ancestors 1,700 years ago. And now we wheel the controls of our time machine. We're back here at the temple on a cold night outdoors and a warm night indoors, 1966. Thank you very much. You were correct, you did not see an everlasting light. There were lights in the synagogue in those days. They just had not survived a Dürer. They were not as important in all probability, and in all probability they weren't simply a single light. They often had a bar in front of their Torah shrine from which a number of lights were hung. What's the difference in Chaldean and Aramaic? About 2,000 years. There are languages off the Akkadian stock, but they are grandnephew and grandfather. The Chaldean does not. When were the signs of the zodiac first conceived or discovered? I'm afraid I have no idea. They're very old. They probably go back to Mesopotamian mathematics, but I would have no idea when. So I've never been an expert in the horoscope. The temple being destroyed, and with it, of course, the function of the priest class, did the priest and the Levites still have a place in the community? They did, but the place was now largely an honorary one. There were priests and Levites who qualified as rabbis and scholars through training. Their function was largely that of to be called first or second to the reading of the Torah, which developed about this time. And secondly, they had one important function to offer the priestly benediction at various times during the service. When the arms were spread out, the shin was made, and they would say, Yivarechacha Adonai v'yishmerecha. They and they alone could do that. Otherwise, their functions were now superseded. Some do, not all. They move on the walls of Dura from the corners towards the temple shrine, towards the Torah shrine. The ones I showed you, I wasn't conscious of that, but that is the depiction in these pictures. What is the physical size of some of these pictures? The Exodus story runs about 5.5 feet by 2.5 feet. Some of them are much smaller. There were different size friezes on the wall. That's about as large as they came. Dürer was unearthed in the early 1930s, and they've been working on it since. It's been a fascinating place because they found not only this synagogue, they found the earliest church with Christian designs and paintings on the wall. They found a Mithra temple. They found these various Roman and Greek pagan temples, which I told you of. It's been a treasure house of archaeological discovery.
Is there any indication that the work in Dürer was done by Jewish artists? Is it different looking than
the? Is there any indication that the work in Dürer was done by Jewish artists? No, there is none. It is one belief, this is all theory now, that there was a conventional art form which these men simply worked with when they were told which biblical stories they were told to produce. The first art, apparently in the catacombs in Rome, which are Christian, represent almost entirely Old Testament scenes. And it's believed that this art and that art all came off of some original stock, or it has an original, a unique history to its own. We don't know. There are no Hebrew inscriptions. There are Greek and there are Aramaic inscriptions at various places in this room. No, there is no continuity. As far as men have imposed presumed continuities on these stories, but there's no self-evident continuity. I showed it to you in terms of the biblical continuity, but that is not.
Yes. Pompeii? Not that I know of. The question was, are there any Jewish frescoes in Pompeii? Maybe somebody has been there more recently than I was this age when I was there. I don't know, but I don't think there are. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. present form. The siddur has evolved in every generation. It's still in the process of evolving, and the Orthodox siddur is still in the process of evolving. The first siddur, which we know of as a book, comes out of the 9th and 10th century, the siddur of Rav Amram. But already in the 2nd century, we know that the rabbis had worked towards defining the basic skeleton of the prayers. The Shema and its blessings before and after were known. The Amida was known in its basic form. And as I told you, in the 3rd century, the Aleinu was written. So that it is slowly evolving. And the prayer book, as I think I said at one of these meetings a few years ago, the prayer book is a constantly evolving book. It's like a notebook, put in pages and take out of them. The Orthodox siddur has never had a set form. It's had a set skeleton. But hymns, prayers have always been added to it. They've added in recent times prayers over the Churban, the great destruction of European Jewry. Yes. Dura is an uninhabited place today. It's been uninhabited all these years. Near where? It's on the upper reaches of the Euphrates River. It's on the border of Syria and Iraq. Yes. I heard human sacrifice, but I didn't hear the rest of the question. Do all the primitive religions involve human sacrifice? No, some did. And one of the reasons that some people believe that the story of the abortive sacrifice of Isaac is in the Bible is as a protest against human sacrifice, which of course never had a place in Judaism. If you go to Jerusalem today, and you walk on the balcony of the King David Hotel, looking out towards the great Crusader walls of the city, you look over a valley, which is called the Valley of Gehinnom, which became the word Gehinnon, hell. And it was in this valley where, according to tradition, some of the Canaanites performed human sacrifice. Yes? We have no idea. They disappear just like their city. The only reason we know of them is because the ruins exist. This was a caravan town, a fortress town. I doubt it had great scholars or a great academy. It had nothing that was literary that would have lasted. Yes? There are no stories which illustrate the creation, Noah, the flood, Tower of Babel, anything that happens before Abraham. Why not? We know not. Good place to stop. Thank you very much.
All that is yours. That's an act of trust. Perhaps it's one of the most important acts of trust that infants learn when they're very young, that they can afford to let go and go to sleep, and when they wake up, they can reclaim all that is rightfully theirs. Or a far greater act of trust, the farmer. Did you ever see a farmer plant a seed, usually in the fall? And he does so, why? Because he believes that many, many months later, after the long winter has come to an end, that seed which was frozen for 3 or 4 months will suddenly spring to life, and that a green thing will come into existence. He can't prove that it will occur, but he's willing to put in all the effort and time because he trusts that that will occur. Or getting more personal, I suspect some of you spend some time studying. Now, what do you get for your studies? Some of you may get a grade that some may be satisfied with, some may not be satisfied with, but what is a grade? Will it get you on a bus to take you downtown? Could you go to a restaurant? Will it buy you a meal? Would it repair your shoes if you got a hole in your soles? What are you going to do with the grades that you study for? That's not why you study. You study because someday you trust the education will be of immense value to you. You trust the purposes for which you study. And if you don't, I imagine you find it rather difficult to spend time studying. If you don't really believe that your studying has a purpose. And this is why many people who live not so far from here, just a few blocks away in some of the slum areas of our city, find difficulty studying. They don't really believe it will help them, just like it did not help their older brothers, their fathers, and their grandfathers. You must have trust before you study. What does this all say? It says very simply, if you're going to do anything in this world, you got to believe and trust that it has a purpose and that it can be done. And this basically is what religion is really all about. Religion, its basic teaching, certainly that of Judaism, is that man has a right to trust this universe. What does Judaism teach? It says very simply, life is good. Trust living. It's worthwhile to live. It says very simply, people, no matter how nastily they may act at times, people basically are good. People can be trusted. And also it says this world of ours, though very frequently it finds itself in a pickle, this world itself can be improved. This world can be perfected. This world can be trusted. This is what the story of Noah and the flood indicates. God, after the storm which led to the flood had ended, told man, I'm going to put a rainbow in the clouds next time it gets stormy. Because from here on in, I want you to be able to trust. I want you to be able to believe that the clouds will go away. I want you to know that you have every right to trust yourself, to trust your neighbors, and to trust this world in which you live. And this is one of the basic teachings of our Jewish faith. Amen.